For some of you, it may be the time that you are dreading. For others, the time that you're waiting for. We've come to the time for question and answer. I think when we apply ourselves to good work, sometimes it can seem like the time goes by very fast. Yeah. But starting to work with this, if you are starting to work with it, you know, it's just... just a beginning. Please, I hope, if you've gained a sense of how to work with this, that you would apply and deepen and develop. Give yourself the time and the space to do that. It's such valuable work. Yeah. I talked about, you know, 1, 2, 3 seconds. Yes, we can see the shift in that time. We can feel it. When we do, then we know, oh, there's possibility here. This can work for me. Sometimes it takes a few hours, a few days, a few weeks of sitting with the things in this kind of way and working with them.
Do you want me to read you a question, or do you want to...
You're welcome to read it.
Okay. Oh. So there were a couple of questions along these lines. Can anger ever be a useful emotion?
Oh. Such a good question. Can anger ever be a useful emotion? Certainly. For the kind of work that we're talking about here, then the arising of anger lets us know that there's something going on there. Something important to care for and attend to. The difficulty with anger is that, like some other emotions, it can have a kind of intoxicating effect. So these amazing scientists who are looking at like different kinds of thoughts and emotions and then what kind of chemicals get formed in the body and then pass through have noticed that like anger, hatred, other things like that. It's not only that the Buddha just spoke about them as poisons, as a kind of euphemism or poetic something or that kind of thing. They really, literally, they do act as poisons in our body. And in terms of our hearts or our sense of our heart, we really certainly can feel also in that way, like our heart is being burned up by anger or being frozen. Some people get hot with anger, some people get cold and like constricted. There are many different kinds of patterns there. Or like anger is eating us up or these kinds of things. Generally, when such a feeling is there, actually there's something physical going on at the level of the body as well that's harmful, that's unhealthy, that can cause or contribute to disease and unwellness. And the opposite is also true. These beautiful, benevolent, blessed mental states that we've been talking about and entertaining today, as well as mindfulness and clear awareness, can actually like bathe the body. In the suttas, when the Buddha is using this analogy of like the high mountain lake with the lotuses like submerged in the pure, clear, limpid water, and like that feeling of being so submerged, so bathed by these most beautiful qualities of mind in our meditation, the scientists are seeing actually literally the body is bathing itself with medicine. Yeah, like medicine water, and the neural synapses that were getting fried and broken down, like they get repaired, and you know, it's amazing. And so when we experience after meditation feeling so fresh and clean and clear and almost as if we had an internal shower, there's something real going on with that. And when we open our eyes and you know, everything suddenly just looks so much clearer. We hear some sound like the wind that we hadn't noticed before. And, oh, such a lovely sound. We hear it so clearly, or feel the breeze coming in. Oh, such a feeling like that. And like so smooth, so clean, and very different for all of our senses, even for your tea. or whatever there may have been with your tea, even taste and smell can become so clean and clear. And you try to taste your food when you're angry. Even how are you going to digest? Right? It affects all of these things, yeah, and in such a kind of way. And yet, I mean, as a wake-up call to let us know, you know, there's something important here to give care and attention to. It's helpful and important in that regard, yeah? And also as a kind of a yardstick to see whether more care and attention is needed, whether an issue has been resolved or not. If we're still getting angry about it, it's a really good, you know, good sign to be able to see and know that and understand, you know, there's still more here that needs more care. So it certainly can be helpful in these regards, yeah? Plus the person who never got angry, sometimes they can have difficulties with compassion when others get angry. Like, I'm so great, I never get angry, and look at that poor, disgusting scum over there who's like angry all the time, looking down on and negatively judging others. So experiences of pain and suffering in terms of potential for developing and deepening our compassion, our kindness, our appreciation, and our equanimity all can be very useful in these regards. We don't want to deliberately be cultivating them for the sake. There's plenty already. But when we're talking about bringing up a thought of something happening that we have gotten upset about, you know, we're using our memory to activate something that's unhealthy, yeah, deliberately, for the sake of bringing understanding, awareness, and then care to that. With regards to the asavas analogy, looking at that as being like wound or sickness or something, to see, you know, where it is, to understand, is there still some pathology there, is there still some infection there or not? And if there's not, okay, healthy, clean, and if there is, to bring medicine to that is ever so appropriate, right? So, you know, maybe you got a cut and you're not thinking about it, and you know, then something happens to bring your mind to it, yeah? And then you feel it again, and oh, right? And maybe you wish you didn't bring your mind to it, but perhaps it needs some care and attention, and to put on some balm so that it doesn't get infected or can heal or that kind of thing. So that's not bad. We can look at that as being a good, helpful thing, a kind of expedient means. Yeah.
You mentioned somatic and had us use our hands. How can we use our bodies in this kind of practice at home?
This can be something wonderful to explore for ourselves. I've worked a lot with just using the mind, but the way that I learned using the mind for this, sometimes we use the body to just get a sense of it. And I saw a doctor of Chinese traditional medicine recently who said that he thought it's very good to work with these things just in mind. That's most important. But if there's some place where there's been pain or trauma with regards to the body, to also not only to just think to that place, but also think about bringing the loving kindness and compassion into the hand and touching that place as well. So there's the physical as well as the mental link that's going there. I'm touching my knee because I injured my knee recently. And I've been sending it loving kindness and appreciation and compassion. And number one, it can be really good for pain relief. And number two, I think it helps it to heal better. Plus, it just seems like a good thing to do as a kind and compassionate human being. And when we develop the ability to do this with ourselves in this kind of way, sometimes it can give us the confidence also to touch others with such compassion and care, because we become familiar with how to bring kindness and compassion into our hands and into our bodies, and to really sense whether that's there or not, and to sense places also. We can ask ourselves, even like with our eyes closed, and just honestly by ourselves, no need to report back, but is there any place in the body that I'm not able to bring kindness and compassion? And to just see if there's anywhere that's like that. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Sometimes people find they can only feel the kindness and compassion in just like a very small place in the body, and the rest of the body is like not available, or the kindness and compassion is not available for that. And then seeing about, can it be moved? Can it be spread? Can it be brought to the entirety of the body, even like the space around the body? And then when we're talking about radiating out, as we did this morning, in one direction and also in from that one direction, the other directions, it's such a great thing to practice. And certainly, yes, we can practice with touch. We can practice with movement. Sometimes starting with the mind and then going to the body. For other people, starting with the body is good. And then it's like from the body, we can really see the feelings, and then we can really see and work with what's going on in the mind. You can be creative in this regard. As was mentioned earlier, just try to avoid harmfulness, avoid harm, with a mind of benevolence.
So this one might be a little bit related. How do we cultivate mudita at the times we feel so much lack and suffering ourselves? Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I was thinking of those depressed periods of our lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yes. So, yeah.
Well, I was speaking earlier, and I want to speak again now, of these different qualities of karuna and mudita as being the natural response of the loving heart to different kinds of circumstances, different kinds of situations. And where there's pain and suffering, then compassion can be, not always, but can be the first kind of natural response to that. But that question might be speaking to when there's a habit of mind to look at the negative side of things or look at the dark side of things, and there's not an equal habit of mind or greater habit of mind to look at what is going well for oneself and for others, making one negative, which can contribute to feeling depressed. And then actually cultivating the intention to see where there isn't pain. For example, I talked about the painful knee, right? I can bring compassion to the painful knee. Does that mean that the entire body is painful in the same kind of way? No. There are other parts that are doing relatively well, with regards to our minds, our hearts, our relationships, our lives, what's going on in the world. It's so natural for our minds to go to the things that seem negative and problems, because we're kind of geared for that. If there's a problem, then try to fix it. Sometimes we can become obsessed by this though, and then it can undermine us. Giving time and care to looking at the things that are going well, the things that aren't hurt, the things that aren't broken, and opening up the possibility for the wholesome feelings of appreciation, gladness, even joy. Deliberately turning our minds towards these things, both externally in the world and other people and things. Like I was talking about the, you know, mudita for the trees getting rain or plants getting rain that they may be appreciating. Now, a certain negative tendency of mine may be like, oh, but what kind of chemicals are in the rain, and is it poisoning the trees, and oh dear, and we're destroying ourselves and our environment. Like this can come up very quickly if there's a pattern of mind like that. And if we see that coming up, yes, there are very important things there to attend to. It's not to deny that. Not to shut off our awareness of that, not that we shouldn't be responsive, and yet to be just compulsively thinking about the negative things over and over again. Sometimes it's like we can even defeat our ability to do something helpful just because of that. So we have to also be able to step back, yes, recognize that, put that down for a moment, and there is the good and the beautiful that's going on, and not let ourselves be blocked from experiencing that. If we've got out of the habit of it, then put a little effort to bring the habit up again intentionally on a daily basis. Yeah. And it's like it will start slowly to come to life again because it's a natural ability for us. It's a natural quality. If it gets a little nurturance and care, it will start to grow like a plant that wasn't being taken care of, and now you start to take care of it nicely and starts blooming and growing. And next thing you know, you find, oh, I've become a person who is able to see and appreciate good things on a daily basis, again. And then you can also check your experience and find out whether that seems to be healthy for you, whether that's giving you good energy, and like nurturance, nutriment, and support for whatever your wonderful works are. With regards to the many things in this world and your own experience of life, whether it's contributing to your well-being or not. These are like the checkpoints, the touchstones, yeah? And remember, mudita for yourself also. Okay. You can avoid on the one side going into pride and conceit, and avoid on the other side going into self-depreciation, beating yourself up. Neither of those. Yes, you can have healthy joy and gladness and appreciation for yourself also.
What motivated you to like a monastic life? Or maybe to become a monastic?
Well, if I contemplate that question even for like 1 second, really thinking about it, then I have to consider, seriously consider the possibility of past lives. There's so much that I can explain in this lifetime, and there's the part that I can't really explain in this lifetime. In this life, love for and real interest in the Buddha's teaching, hair on fire, interest in the paradigm of the seeker, and with so many questions, so many doubts, so many concerns about the pains and sufferings in the world and people's relationships and greater dynamics in society, politics, environment, all of that, feeling the need, heart need to really like get down to the root, get down to the bottom of these things and do the work that I felt inside myself needed to be done. And quite a lot of that has been done. It's not all done yet, but there's so much that has been. I'd say in the first years of my monastic life, There was the time where I was just trying to practice so sincerely, so dedicatedly, and even many kinds of things like to stay awake all night for meditation, or to sit up, or to just eat once a day, or to go to walk barefoot, or sleep under the trees, or all these kinds of things. I love to try so many of them for what I thought was strong practice, because I thought if I try harder, maybe I can break through this wall that I feel in myself, in my own mind. I have to tell you that trying harder part, I'm not exactly sure that has ever worked. But other things, fortunately, in the Buddha's teaching have, and sometimes trying harder and then really looking at the dynamics and seeing how, like, oneself is putting up the wall in one's own mind and then pushing against it. So it's kind of like, I don't know, I understand rock climbing is popular in Brisbane in some areas, and, you know, anyway, if you want to climb a wall or try to break through it, then to create the wall for it, give yourself a pick. Okay, you've got a job, and you may feel perhaps some satisfaction in doing that. But a certain recognition started to dawn on me at a particular point that's what was going on. It's possible also to, like, let the wall come down and, you know, just go ahead. Like, not needing to do that particular thing anymore in that kind of way. So, it's been a long time now, 30 years. And so my old motivation in monastic life and my contemporary motivation in monastic life are somewhat different, I'd say, because the path has been effective in some ways, the work of the path. You know, that there has been the benefit that's come from that. So my motivation is a bit different now at this time. Now I just feel like monastic life is like happy and comfortable. I don't feel like I would. Please forgive me for saying this, but when I look at lay life, I'm like, oh dear, oh, I don't see anything that seems so interesting or attractive to me at this time. So, and I don't mean to be putting lay life down in this regard. Actually, I have so much appreciation, because I feel like in monastic life there are the many things that I can do, like suitable for practicing myself, and what many wonderful ways that I can share blessings with our world. And I really see the benefit and blessings in that, and I'm happy with that. And also I see for friends who are in lay life with their Dhamma practice, the things that they can do that are really outside of the sphere of monastic life that I think are so excellent, so helpful, so important in their choiceful right livelihood and the way that they're engaging with their practice. And then how some of them also as teachers can then teach to others who are in similar situations and really be of an enormous help and blessing and benefit. And I'm so happy, happy and glad to see all of that. Yeah. So my thought is, for whatever is really our deepest heart's intention and motivation, our sense of meaning, if we can touch into that, live true to that, whatever form that calls us to, whatever that means, whatever it takes, that's good. Yeah. If that means monastic life, then good. If that doesn't mean monastic life, then good. I love the paradigm of the fourfold community in the early Buddhist teaching. And really I feel it's so important for us to see exemplars and those who really have practiced and understand the Dhamma deeply and well in many different forms of life, including monastic, non-monastic, all genders. Yeah, even all ages. Yeah.
So we have a question could you talk a bit about her story? And I had posted on the Heart Insight Facebook page last night, I had posted the talk that you had offered. The one that you posted the YouTube of, I shared to the Heart Insight Facebook on bhikkhunis in society. So I don't know, perhaps somebody heard some part of that or heard you mention it earlier. And we do have a final question about Facebook. I'm saving, you know, the best for last on the questions. But yeah, so the you also did mention here, though. And so could you talk a bit about her story?
His story, her story, our story. Her story means to be conscious about the patterns that we've had in relatively recent times in humanity. Even in English, to use the word his story, which can get parsed out as his story. And to be conscious of that. In Buddhism, there are many teachings from ancient great leading women teachers and practitioners in Buddhism. And there are patterns of, in some places, both in Asia and in the West, of not knowing about, not recognizing, not telling those stories. And I feel that it's really valuable that we do so. You heard that I was in Sri Lanka for the past couple of months, and I heard from some friends in Sri Lanka, there was a group of about 10 women that I was meeting with and talking to. And I was talking about some of the ancient women disciples of the Buddha and one particular woman's story. And one of the ladies who was there said, you know, if we had only heard these stories when we were growing up, they're from the Pali Text canon. They're from the early Buddhist teaching. They come within a category of teachings that we generally called Sanghanusati, which would be like remembering the Sangha or mindful recollection of the Sangha and particular members of the Sangha that we think the Buddha asked to be remembered, highly commended. So that particular lady mentioned that when she was young, she and her peers heard the story of Visakha over and over again. There's a smile in the back here. So Visakha was a great patron, a great laywoman devotee and patron of the Buddhist Sangha. According to her story, I think she was great, and her story is not the only one. Amongst upasika, means non-monastic, lay women. And I don't like to use the word lay here, in fact, I'll tell you why. But among lay women disciples of the Buddha in the Pali Text, there are 10 who are highly commended and recognized by the Buddha, with the Buddha asking us to remember and recollect them. They're recorded in the canonical texts, and for bhikkhunis, 13. Their stories are very different, each one of them. They're not all the same. And among that group of 10 women, it's just kind of a coincidence of the 10 upasikas, 10 lay women in the Pali Text, and then 10 women in the room. There was one who said that she felt inspired by hearing those stories told by the monks of Visakha. It was inspiring to her. She loved it, and she felt such a role model for her life. The other 9 of the 10, not so much. Not so much. And they said, if we had heard some of these stories of these other women when we were younger, that would have been inspiring. That would have been encouraging. That would have been a role model that I feel like I could have engaged with. That would have really motivated me. Hearing it now, it motivates me. But now I'm old. If only I had heard this when I was young. And this is within a Theravada Buddhist culture. Yeah? So I find this very significant. And for myself in monastic life, for those who I've seen as exemplars, yeah? Early on, I found the story of one of the ancient bhikkhunis, Bada Kundalakesi. Yeah? Her story is kind of radical. Those who know the story are nodding now. Such a great inspiration and encouragement to me. A few years later, doesn't really motivate me in the same kind of way, but some other, for some other reason. Then I feel the real value of having these stories, of preserving them, of telling them, how they're meant to give us inspiration and encouragement and motivation, and let us know we don't have to be just one particular blueprint to be, you know, to really experience excellence in this path, or to be like, you know, what the Buddha himself was blessing and commending. There are a lot of different possibilities there. Some of the Buddha images that you see in some lovely temples and Dhamma centers, the Buddha images there, and then they even sometimes use a stencil for the great disciples of the Buddha. You have them all on one side, stencil, 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 and all on the other side. It gives the impression that they're all the same somehow. And yet, if we look at their stories, this is where the story becomes very valuable. We realize so different, so unique, and maybe the different and the unique one like me too. There is the space, there is the opening, there is the path and the practice for me too in this. I love, though, with the art, when also they're painted all different colors rather than all one color, and when they're not all the same height. Yeah, they don't all have the same features. The Buddha taught walking through 16 countries at that time. We think it's India, but 16 different countries, and, you know, going to people in many different walks of life, from different ethnicities, different racial backgrounds, different religious backgrounds. Yeah. And that was part of his, you know, paradigm, his intention, his great compassion for teaching. That sometimes the visual images or the way the stories are told, much more narrow, selective, just one story or a few, gives a different impression that's not so inclusive and not necessarily so helpful. So helpful and supportive. So that's a little something about her story in our contemporary times. Not only the ancients, but those in between, and also those now. I feel this is important to be conscious about where we are and what we're doing now in Buddhism as well. Bring that intentionality in. We can feel comfortable that that's actually in harmony with the Buddha's own paradigm from the early Buddhist teachings, which is what Theravada Buddhism is affirmatively like meant to be, preserving, living, practicing, and passing down.
Thank you. I have now it's the Facebook question, and I also had somebody ask me if we'll be posting the recordings that I'm diligently trying to make today. I hope so. So if the gizmo works as planned, I'll post something on the Heart Insight Facebook page, probably a link to where you might listen to the audio recordings from today. So that's what I know about Facebook. And what would you like to share about Facebook?
Well, that's a whole other day long.
In fact, the Mitra conference that I was a speaker for and part of in Sydney, one of the Buddhist monks there was invited to give a breakout group on just this kind of topic, that is bringing, you know, the Dhamma and mindfulness, intentionality to our use of social media. I think that was, I hope that that was recorded. I heard that it was really good. And I have to say for myself, you know, my first 5 years of monastic life, I went cold turkey from media. Facebook wasn't around at that time. And I'm really glad to have gone cold turkey from media for a period of time and to have a chance to develop my practice with a step back and out of that for a period of time, and then coming back into that, bringing the practice back into it, then I was able to see the things in a very different way, which is valuable then for insight and for further training and further practice, and that's ongoing. One day a few years ago, I think it was 8 years ago, I got an email from my mom saying that she wanted me, that I had become a grand auntie, and that she wanted me to see pictures of the grand niece. And then there was a link to click. So I clicked on the link. Next thing you know, I have a Facebook account. So I got to see the pictures, and then I got to see, oh, this is like a whole other world, like worlds within worlds, right? So I tend to think about it as being a kind of global village. So in Buddhist monastic life, we were trained in how we go for Pindapat, or like living in the monastery, then if we're going to go out somewhere into the global village, into the small local village or global village, city or town, like to be mindful of the body, be mindful of our feelings, mindful of our mind, to be intentional, even to take like each step going for Pindapat intentionally, like intentional about my robes, intentional about my bowls, intentional about my senses, like what are my eyes going to, as we were talking about earlier on, really aware of what's going on at the eye gate, at the ear gate, with regards to the body, all of these things, and to be actively working with them. So I tend to see Facebook in this kind of way, kind of like going into town on Pindapat somehow. So to be mindful and intentional, I go for a purpose. And for that purpose, and then return to my place of abiding. And so in that paradigm, then depending on what kind of experience one has going into the village, then one comes back to the temple, the monastery, the cave, the forest, seat under a tree, whatever it may be, and then brings that experience into the practice and progressively works with it. Yeah, and then what's understood from that is used to inform our choiceful behavior the next time. So on a daily basis for Pindapat, most of the time, I don't go to Facebook every day. So I don't think I have to go like Pindapat on a daily basis. But using that kind of paradigm, so like to go in mindfully, intentionally, and also coming out mindfully, intentionally, and then look and see what's there, what's going on with that. Bring that to the cushion, bring it to the practice, wisely reflect upon it. If there's anything that's come up that seems to be calling for care, anything that's been activated, to give that care, to do that work, and then to bring the blessings from that back into the process of going again. Likewise with coming here today. Yeah, likewise.
And there is a Dhammadrini Facebook page.
There is a Dhammadrini Facebook page. Yeah, it's true. A place for sharing teachings and finding out what's going on and with regards our sangha and our community and the connected associated bhikkhunis communities, and any topics that seem of relevance to us. There's Buddhist monks and nuns private Facebook page or group is there also, which I go to sometimes.
But you have to go forth to get on that one.
That one you're supposed to really be in monastic life to go on. But then there's the aspiring monastics Facebook page. There is. So, you know, it's all about centering on, you know, the things of interest to those who are aspiring to monastic life. And sometimes they invite different monastic teachers to come in and speak to different questions. And so I see that as being like a reflection of what we're doing in person, being able to do that also at a distance via the web together. But I feel like these things, you know, really can be extremely problematic. And you probably know even better than me how, and I hope even why that's so, and then how to work with the problematic aspects that are there. They're not new things. I mean, human beings have been getting obsessive and compulsive about things for quite a long time now. And yet, it is unique in some ways. And I feel like a very good place to really bring mindfulness and to bring, you know, discipline, to bring our training out of care for ourselves and care for each other, not to just go like, is it helter-skelter over the cliff or something like this, just because everybody else is going that way. I used to live in northeastern Washington state, which is an area that was called cattle country. And we'd do things like have bonfires and someone would play the guitar and play like cattle songs, yeah. Desert silvery blue beneath the pale moonlight. And this song talks about, from the cowboy or cowgirl's perspective, the tendency for the cattle, when there's a flash of lightning or something that startles them, to run, and then to run together. And many of them may not even know why they're running. They're just moving together because all their peers, everybody else, is just moving together. But when they're running like that, the danger is that they come to a cliff edge, and then they go down. And in that area, really, there are the high cliffs and precipices like that. And for the rancher, for the cowboy or cowgirl, then if that happens, they lose their livelihood and can take years. And, you know, maybe they end up broke from that. It means like they'll lose everything if that happens. So I got a sense for humanity of our tendency to sometimes like run together with things just because it's popular, just because it's trending, just because some emotional feeling arises in us and then moves us together. I feel like good to look out, good to take care. And sometimes, as in monastic life, if you can, sometimes good to like take a pause, step out of that, get your bearings, see where everybody is running. And if we become well established in that ourselves, sometimes also we can put in a stop sign or a turn off here, come out this way to safety. We can set up something like this, even if we have the strength and the establishment to give a hand to others with the things that are helpful to gain perspective ourselves, to be choiceful, and not to just, you know, be crashing on into our harm, danger, detriment, and death. Yeah. So I appreciate those old cowboy songs. Yeah. Yes. So for those who might be thinking, wait, she's not supposed to be singing, is she? Yes, I have a song for you. Actually, I want to take a moment of pause before that. So, this is a time now to give our hearts to, or to give to our hearts, gratitude and appreciation. For this space and everything that's been offered here, space of safety, all of the facilities around us coming from kindness, generosity, compassion, and all of the human efforts to our friends who have organized, and to ourselves also, for showing up. for doing what we feel we need for ourselves, what is healthy, helpful, wholesome, even liberating for our hearts. Gratitude and appreciation radiating outwards and radiating inwards to ourselves through this body. Sitting with gratitude. Seeing what it feels like. And as it rises to our heart, to allow ourselves to smile, if that's what comes. Allow the body to shift and to reorient with the thought and heart of gratitude and appreciation. And kindness to all beings around. I don't know their names, though. Birds, other beings, the trees. Many humans, near and far. Also beings of the great waters. The air. Unseen beings. If we have any guardian angels, our Kalyanamitas, our spiritual teachers, companions on the path, blessing them with love and appreciation, gratitude. To all beneficent forces, all beneficent beings, and our love out to all of life, everything imaginable. Unqualified. Just happy to allow our minds and hearts to be healthy. And well. To know what is beautiful and excellent in human life. Amidst all of the joys and sorrows, all of the trials and tribulations, breathing in, breathing out, peace to all things, inside and out. If you don't have it, or don't feel like joining together, you're welcome to just put your hands over your heart and join at heart. If you don't feel like pronouncing the words together, you can just hum along as your heart moves you. All these are open to you. I hear that not everyone has the Pali. So, my plan then is to chant the English. Actually, I think I may chant just a very little part of the Pali just to start, just so you can hear. And if you do have the Pali, you're welcome to join. Just a very little part of it. Those who have the Pali, you can see in the beginning, metta sahagatena cetasa. From there, I want to go down to the last line. So just the very beginning and the very end. Down to the last line means down to vipulena mahagatena. So just the very beginning and the very end. And then we're going to go to the English. Metta sahagatena cetasam vipulena mahagatena appamanena averena appyapacchena paritova viharati. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a mind imbued with compassion. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with compassion, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a mind imbued with gladness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with gladness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So thanks so much to everyone for this good time together. I'd like to remember the Buddha's advice for when members of the Sangha come together and then go their separate ways. For whatever was good, let us hold that, let us keep that, let us keep it well, carrying it lightly, not heavily, in our small pack of the things that are of true value, true meaning and worth in this life, with the thought, let me make good with this, let me make much of this, for the good and the benefit that I've received, let it not be lost, rather let me let it grow and come to fruition, let me realize the benefits of this in this life. And if there was anything that wasn't good, to think about having free permission to leave it behind, not to carry with one. To put into the compost bin, and then let it go to rot with all of the other compost, and let the worms take care that it becomes excellent fertilizer for the next generation of flowers and fruits to come, with the wish, may I also bless others and benefit from this myself as well. Yeah. An open invitation.
So I will be teaching tomorrow at Heart Insight Meditation in the West End. That's just an evening program. The topic is the fire sermon.
Topic is the fire.
Yeah. So it's that haiku. Actually, do you know the address?
71. 71.